as a basis for our study this evening. And of course, as you see in your outline or on the screen, we're going to be talking about Nathan the prophet this evening. And you'll see in just a moment, of course, you can see in your outline why we designate which Nathan we're going to be talking about, because there are several that are mentioned in the Old Testament. Beginning in 2 Samuel chapter 12, beginning there in verse 1, it says, "And the Lord sent Nathan unto David, and he came unto him, and said unto him, There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him. And with his children, it did eat of his own meat, and drank of his own cup, and lay in his bosom, and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him." And we'll stop at that point with our reading this evening. We identify the Nathan that we're going to be looking at briefly this evening as Nathan the prophet, because there are several Nathans that are mentioned in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. Interestingly enough, when we begin to look at that, we see that one of the sons of David, when he left the city of Hebron and went to Jerusalem after being anointed as king, was named Nathan. And you see that in 2 Samuel chapter 5 in verse 14, 1 Chronicles chapter 3 in verse 5. And you can see that the lineage of Christ through David was followed through Nathan there. That Nathan in Luke chapter 3 and verse 31. Later on in 2 Samuel chapter 23 and there verse 36, we see that Nathan is the father of a man by the name of Egal, who was one of David's heroes, as we might say. That is, one of David's mighty men of valor. And there's a list of those mighty men of valor there in that text. Three that stood out above the rest, and then 37, as we see later on. In fact, you see Nathan mentioned there in that context. And then when you go on down in verse 39, interestingly enough there in 2 Samuel chapter 23, you see a man by the name of Uriah the Hittite, who is also numbered among those 37 there. And then we read about a man whose name was Nathan in 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 5, who was the father of one of Solomon's chief officers. I guess if we were to try to compare it to something today, we would say he was the father of one of Solomon's cabinet members. And then later on, in fact, several hundred years later, after the kingdom of Judah had been captured, Babylonian captivity, and a remnant returned with Ezra, we see that one of the chief men who returned to Israel with him was a man by the name of Ezra. There's another Nathan mentioned in Ezra chapter 10 and verse 39, and he's listed there as one of those individuals who put away his foreign wife. And then yet we find in Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 12, another man mentioned by the name of Nathan. And so you could do quite an interesting study, and a lengthier study, looking at men who are named Nathan in the Old Testament. But of course, the Nathan that stands out in our minds, I dare say, is the one that we read about in 2 Samuel chapter 12. The man who comes to David there and reproves him for the sins that we read about in 2 Samuel chapter 11. And he's a great Bible character. In fact, as we go back just a little bit earlier, we see that as we think about some events in the life of Nathan the prophet, you don't read a biography of Nathan. You don't read somewhere that it says so-and-so begat Nathan. We don't read things like that about Nathan. But we see that he merely appears on the scene in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And he begins to be prominent in the reign there of David. And I want us to go back to 2 Samuel 7 and notice just a couple of things here I think are helpful to us. Some things that are instructive. As we see at least two things of great significance taking place here in 2 Samuel chapter 7. As we go through verse 12 or 13 or so. The first thing we see is that in the earlier part of the chapter, David wants to build a temple for the Lord. A very noble aspiration on the part of David. He says, "I'm living in a fine house. And the Ark of the Covenant, it's in a tent. He says, I want to build a house for the Lord. In fact, in chapter 7 in verse 2, the king said unto Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the Ark of God dwelleth within curtains. And as he expresses his desire to build a temple, to build a house for God, a place for the residence of the Ark of the Covenant, Nathan says, do it. That sounds like a good idea. Look with me as we go and look at verse 3. Nathan said unto the king, go do all that is in thine heart, for the Lord is with thee. One of the things that we see here is that every time a prophet spoke, and it's quite obvious here, he wasn't speaking by inspiration. He wasn't speaking by divine revelation. Nathan is simply speaking what's in his heart here as well. And we see later on in the fourth verse that the word of the Lord comes to Nathan and reveals some things to Nathan and some things to David about the building of that house. Beginning here in verse 4 of 2 Samuel chapter 7, it says, and it came to pass that night that the word of the Lord came unto Nathan, saying, go and tell my servant David, thus saith the Lord, shalt thou build me a house for me to dwell in? Whereas I have not dwelt in any house since the time that I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day, but have walked in a tent and in a tabernacle. And then verse 7, and here's a verse I would try to remember. Here's a verse I would try to remember in the context of someone who would try to justify a particular religious observance, some kind of religious matter, on the basis of God didn't say not to. That's one of the favorite arguments sometimes that people make when they want to justify something that there's no authority for. They say, well, God didn't say not to. Look at what we find here in this verse as God continues to reveal His will about whether or not David should build this tabernacle. In verse 7 again, God says, in all the places wherein I have walked with all the children of Israel, spake I word with any of the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to feed my people Israel, saying, why build ye me not a house of Caesar? What's God saying here? He's saying, I never gave that commandment. I never gave that commandment. I never instructed you to build me a house of cedar, to build me a temple, David. And what can we necessarily infer from that? In the absence of God's instruction, David had no right to act. Anything on his part at that point would be simply presumption. It'd be going out and taking an action on his own. Now, had David been like a lot of people today, he could have argued, well, Lord, you didn't say, don't build me a temple. But obviously, David didn't do that. He understood the significance of what God is saying here. And there's a lesson here on the silence of the Scriptures. When God has not spoken, when God has not commanded, when He hasn't given instruction, when we can't turn to the Bible, obviously, that which is authoritative for us today, and find book and chapter and verse, as we say, for the thing that we're about to do, for the worship that we're to engage in, or what we use engaging in that worship, or something dealing with the work or the organization of the local church, unless we can find it authorized by God, we're not to do it. Silence does not permit anything. God's silence isn't permissive. What is silence? It's nothing, is it? It's the absence of speech. We're going to see later on in just a little while that when God wanted something done, that He communicated that, that He revealed that. God had not given a commandment, and David wasn't to go forward simply doing what was in his heart. A little bit later, we see in that chapter, beginning there in about verse 11, that Nathan reveals something to David about his house and about his seed. But he's speaking here of his family. He's speaking here of his seed, who would be Christ, and the fact that his throne would be established forever. And beginning in verse 11, and just making an observation or two here, as the prophet Nathan continued to address David in verse 11, he said, and as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that He will make thee a house. God hasn't told you to build Him a house, but He's going to make you a house. He's talking there about the family of David. And of course, as we read here, we see that Nathan is telling David that it will be your seed, your lineage, whose kingdom and throne will be established forever. That is, David was a descendant. David was an ancestor of Jesus Christ. His throne would be established forever. Beginning in verse 12. And when thy days shall be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. There are a lot of passages that we could look at in conjunction with this. I would remind you of Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1, the first verse as we look at the first gospel account. And that's the fact that when the genealogy of Jesus is presented here, the affirmation is made that he's both of the lineage of David and of the lineage of Abraham. And then in the book of Luke, chapter 1, and beginning there in about verse 30, and going through verse 32 or 33, the angel Gabriel, speaking to Mary, said unto her, Fear not, Mary, for thou hast found favor with God. And behold, thou shalt conceive in thy womb and bring forth a son, and shall call his name Jesus. He shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And this is not the primary point of our lesson this evening, and so I simply want to make mention of something else. And that is, when you go to Acts the second chapter, there you see in that sermon that the Apostle Peter preached on the day of Pentecost, beginning about verse 29 or so and going through verse 33, 34, and on through 36, the Apostle Peter makes the point that when God raised Jesus from the dead, he raised him up to sit on his throne in fulfillment of the Old Testament promises and prophecies there made to David. In 2 Samuel chapter 12, we're moving on and looking at some events here in the life of Nathan. We see that Nathan reproves David for his sins involving Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. As we have time, we'll come back to that in just a little bit. Some more interesting things that we see here in the life of Nathan the prophet. When Solomon is born, in that same chapter, in chapter 12 and verse 25 of 2 Samuel, he gives to Solomon the name of Jedidiah, which means beloved of God. And then later on, at the end of David's reign, David is old and David is sick and David is having trouble even keeping himself warm. And his son Adonijah, who was a brother of Absalom that had already been slain, his son Adonijah was trying to usurp the throne. And we see that Nathan assists Solomon in taking his rightful place on that throne. In that account there, he goes to Bathsheba and he says, you see what is happening here. The throne has been promised to Solomon. And he says, you go to David, you tell him what's happening. And he says, after you do that, I will come in and I will confirm that. And they do that. And David says, you set Solomon on my mule and you proclaim him as being king over the people. Turn with me, if you would, to 2 Chronicles chapter 29 and here verse 25. One of the things to notice, I think, and it's going to be the other side of the coin, so to speak, to an argument that we made just a little while ago, or a point that we made just a little while ago, and that is, we see as Hezekiah, many years later, is restoring the temple, rebuilding the temple, that he's seeking to establish the worship that God had ordained. And we see that part of that worship had been commanded by God to Nathan the prophet. This part here. It says in 2 Chronicles chapter 29 and verse 25, And he set the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with psalteries, and with harps, according to the commandment of David and of Gad the king's seer and Nathan the prophet. Then I've got underlined in my Bible the next part of that. It says, For so was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. And I would just make this note. When God wanted his people to worship, and that worship involved the use of instrumental music, he was able to give the instructions. And he did give the instructions here. That's how that they knew to do that. That's how that they knew to establish and use that as a part of their worship in the Old Testament. If God wanted us to use mechanical instruments of music today involved in our worship to Him, then He would be able to give those instructions. He would have given those instructions. In the absence of those, we don't have the permission to do that. Sometimes people make the same argument. They say, well, the Bible doesn't say not to. Well, the silence of the Scriptures is not permissive of anything. If we look at what the Bible teaches about instrumental music, we see that God has specified, and there's a consistent pattern, that God has specified singing. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 16. Here the Apostle Paul says, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. That's what we find when it comes to searching for book and chapter and verse about what the New Testament says, about the kind of music that we're to make, kind of music we're to use when we worship God. Or in similar vein, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 19, it says they're speaking to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. I want to move on, and as we get toward the end of our study, I think we're getting toward the end of our study before we're getting toward the end of our material this evening. We may go back and look at it in a little bit more detail at some point. But I want us to go back and think about the presentation that Nathan makes to David. Here's the thing that we probably most remember about Nathan. It's the way that he approached David there in 2 Samuel chapter 12 after David had committed a whole string of sins there. And the sins that he committed are things that begin with a lustful look, with desire in his heart, having Bathsheba brought to himself. There's adultery that's committed. There's a child that's conceived. There's conspiracy on the part of David to cover up his sin by having Uriah come home off the battlefield and go home to his wife. And what a noble man Uriah is. He says in so many words, I'm not going to enjoy the comforts of home while my men are on the battlefield. And David goes so far as to get Uriah drunk. And Uriah still doesn't enjoy the comforts of his home. And so then David takes his conspiracy even further, and he sends a letter to Joab by the hand of this great man, Uriah. He says, you set him in the forefront of the battle. And then he says, you withdraw from him. And David knew what would happen. And that happened in the battle. And Uriah was slain. And so David takes Bathsheba for his wife. A child is born, the child dies, and so on. But a whole string of sins here, and some simply committed to cover up others, we see on the part of David. How did Nathan approach David on this occasion? And are there some lessons that we can learn from that? We remember the approach of Nathan. He presents to David an account that parallels with David's sin. With David's own sin. He talks about the rich man who has a visitor come and see him. The rich man, he has all kinds of animals. Or I don't know about all kinds, but he has many, many animals that he could take of his own. But he spares to do that. He finds a poor man who had one little lamb that he had raised like a child. And he takes it away from him. He kills it. He dresses it, and he serves it as a meal to this man who was visiting with him. That's the account that Nathan presents there to David. It's not hard to see in our mind's eye how that parallels in so many respects to what David had done. But think about this just for a moment. As David hears this account, he's able to consider it quite objectively, isn't it? That particular account there, it doesn't concern him personally. That person wasn't him except when he begins to make the application. He doesn't have to look at it with emotion involving himself and prejudice regarding his own situation. And Nathan brings him to see the principle of injustice, of cruelty, of selfishness that is so clearly involved. David makes this exclamation about that man. His anger was greatly kindled there in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 5. And he said to Nathan, As the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. Well, that man had simply taken a lamb, an animal. But David sees the principle involved and the kind of penalty that ought to be inflicted on someone who would do such a thing. And then he goes on, he says, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. You know, maybe as we remember this account in the life of Nathan, better than some of the others that we've looked at this evening, I'm assuming just as well that the words we could perhaps quote from Nathan on this occasion are found in verse 7. When Nathan said unto David, "Thou art the man." David had already seen himself. He had already seen the injustice. He had already been able to make his own application, to apply that situation to himself. Or rather, to apply the situation. And then Nathan says, "It's you." He applies the principle to David himself. Let's look as we conclude this evening and briefly at just two or three ways that we can use that same kind, I think, of approach and principles today as we teach some of those who are lost and those who are in error. We won't go through all of these this evening, but they're not difficult to see, I don't think. They're not difficult to see how we could use them in making that kind of application or using them to make that similar kind of approach. For example, if we were speaking or we were trying to teach someone who believed that a person was saved by grace alone, or they might say by faith alone, we could illustrate principles that have been true from the very beginning about those whom God saves, those whom God blesses. And that the key ingredients, so to speak, the key principles that have always been involved in that have not simply been grace, not simply been faith or faith only, but also involve obedience. For example, talk about the case of Noah. That's a familiar illustration. In Genesis, the 6th chapter, in there, verse 8, and speaking of Noah, it says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." Noah was saved by grace, but it wasn't by grace alone. Noah exercised faith. Hebrews chapter 11. Or Noah exercised faith. Hebrews chapter 11. And there, verse 7. Hebrews chapter 11, the whole chapter is about how people please God with an obedient faith. But it says, "By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet." And then comes the active response, isn't it? The obedience. "He moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house." And that goes right hand in hand with what we see at the end of Genesis chapter 6 when we're told that Noah did all that God commanded him. Says there, "Thus did Noah according to all that God commanded him, so did he." There are the principles. You can get a person to see that Noah was saved by God's grace, but not by grace alone. By faith, but not merely some kind of mental assent to a certain set of facts, but by an obedient faith. That parallels salvation today, doesn't it? We're saved by the grace of God, but not by grace alone. Faith is absolutely essential, but not mere mental assent to the facts of the gospel, but an active response that includes obedience to the commandments of the gospel. Let's stay here in Genesis chapter 6 just for a moment. We've already touched on the subject of instrumental music a couple of times this evening. Believe it or not, this isn't a lesson on instrumental music, but we've already touched on that a couple of times this evening. And it's a subject that we need to think about and we need to study and we need to be ready to answer, not only because of our denominational friends and neighbors who don't have any problem with it, who don't see anything wrong with it, but more and more those who would call themselves New Testament Christians. Those who would assemble somewhere where the assembling body is identified as a church of Christ are using mechanical instruments of music. More and more, that's becoming more common. I've made this comment before, but I get most of the time, I think, when that discussion comes up, I begin by talking about the principle. and the principle involved when you think about, again, Noah. And this time, Noah building that ark and a specific commandment that God gave him. Setting down the principle and getting the person to be able to see the principle involved, then simply make the application to instrumental music or whatever else the unauthorized subject might be. In Genesis chapter 6 and verse 14, God said this as He gave Noah instructions to build that ark. He said, "Make thee an ark of gopher wood." And then it continues there. What kind of wood? He said gopher wood, didn't he? That's a specific kind of wood. And I would ask a question like this. What if Noah had made that ark out of pine or oak or birch or just any other kind of wood? Would he have obeyed God? Anybody can see the principle involved there. God specified the kind of wood that Noah was to use. Now, there's another question that goes hand in hand with that. What if God had simply said, "Noah, I want you to build me an ark out of wood"? God didn't do that, but what if He had? Would Noah have had the permission to use whatever kind of wood he would have chosen? Well, sure he would. It's the difference between a specific commandment and a general or generic commandment. We turn to the New Testament. We've already read a couple of the passages this evening. When God commanded the kind of music that we're to make, He said, "Sing." He said, "Sing." That's a specific kind of music, just as gopher was a specific kind of wood. Had God simply said to New Testament Christians, had we simply found the commandment in the New Testament, "Make music when you gather to worship," that would have been general, wouldn't it? That would have been generic in nature. As if though God had said to Noah, "You built me an ark out of wood." But He didn't in either case. And we're not free to choose when God has specified the kind of thing as we see here. I want to touch on just one or two more, just briefly. One of those is this. If you would turn with me to Genesis chapter 37, beginning there in verse 32. So many of the people that we may have contact with are people who base their religion on their emotions, simply on the way that they feel. The idea might be expressed in terms like this. "I know I'm saved because I really feel good about my religion. I know I'm saved because of a certain experience I think I've had," or something of that nature. In Genesis chapter 37, beginning there in verse 32, and you'll remember the account. The brothers of Joseph, after they sold him into slavery, obviously couldn't go home and say, "Guess what? We sold Joseph today." They couldn't do that, so they made up a story. They led Jacob to believe that Joseph was dead. They dip his coat in blood, and they bring it back home. And so in verse 34 it said, "And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days." And verse 35 said, "And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him." It's hard to imagine how disingenuous and hypocritical and dishonest you'd have to be trying, comforting your dad for a lie you just told him. But that's what they're doing here. And he said, "I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. A couple of questions here. Did Jacob think his son was dead? He obviously did, didn't he? Did his emotions tell him that? Was he having an emotional response to the idea that Joseph is dead? Obviously he is. It couldn't have been any stronger, could it? Was he right? Did he have the truth? Did he know the truth simply because he had a certain emotional response? Why, no. Not at all. We can't base our religion upon our feelings, upon our emotions. Look with me then to the other side, Genesis chapter 45, verses 26 and 27. It's interesting to see that when Jacob learns the truth, he doesn't believe it initially. Beginning in verse 25, it says, And they went up out of Egypt, and they came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob, their father, and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not. Here's a man on one hand who believes a lie, and he has this great emotional response. On the other hand, here's the same person, and I think it's about 22 years later, if you add it up, and you can do that, who learns the truth, and he doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe it. He doesn't have a response. I know that's right. The way that we feel about a particular thing, or our religious friends feel about a particular matter, doesn't determine whether it's truth or error. Only God's Word does that. One more, and then the lesson is yours this evening. You can look at those, if you would, in 1 Samuel 8 and 1 Samuel 15. And really what those lessons there show us is this. The end does not justify the means. A lot of people today will argue, well, in order, such and such is a good work. And so we're going to do it this way, when they're using an unauthorized means to do what they view in their own eyes as a good work. We learn in those texts there, and there the principle is seen. The end doesn't justify the means. Sometimes people refuse to obey the gospel because they say, I just don't see any connection between being baptized and receiving the remission of sins. They run that through their minds, and it just doesn't compute in their own human intellect and way of thinking. Here's a lesson. Here's one of those things I'd like to parallel to that situation that I think illustrates the principle. And that's the cleansing of Naaman the leper in 2 Kings chapter 5. Just a couple of verses from that, we learn how Naaman understands that he's to go to the Jordan River and dip 7 times. Initially, he's so angry, he turns away and he has to be talked into doing what has been instructed. In fact, in verses 13 and 14, he's basically saying this. I don't see the need. I don't see the connection. Aren't there other things? Aren't there other rivers that would be just as good? And finally, he's persuaded by his servants who say in verse 13, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much rather when he saith unto thee, wash and be clean? Then went he down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. What connection is there between dipping in the Jordan River 7 times and being cured of leprosy? From a purely human, naturalistic explanation, there's not any. There wasn't any magic potion in the Jordan River that cured leprosy. What was the connection? It was that God said, do it. God said, do it. And he wasn't cleansed till he obeyed God's commandment, whether he could see the connection or not. When was Naaman cleansed? Only when he obeyed God's commandment, regardless of whether or not he saw the reasoning or the connection behind it or not. And again, sometimes people say, well, I just don't see why baptism is necessary for salvation. I just don't see the connection. Well, the connection isn't because there's some magical formula in that water that washes sins away. The connection is this. God has said baptism is the point at which I'm going to forgive, wash away the sins of a penitent believer. And only at that point then does he do that. That's the connection, because God commanded it, because he ordained it as that point at which he washes away sins. In Acts chapter 22 and verse 16, here Saul learned that as Ananias came to him and said, and now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. The lesson is yours this evening. There may be somebody here tonight who recognizes that you need to do what we've just been talking about, that you need to be baptized in water for the remission of your sins, in order to have those sins washed away, to become a child of God, to have the hope of heaven as your eternal home. Maybe someone who's taken those steps but has fallen away. who sees a need to confess sin and pray for forgiveness to be right in God's sight. This evening, won't you come as we stand and sing?